I'm Christoph von Tomme, and welcome to the API Resilience Podcast. If you've ever wondered what it really is we do when we do APIs, and if you've wondered how APIs change organizations, our communities, and our society, look no further. This is the podcast you've been searching for.
In this episode, you can hear a discussion between Koichi Shiroma and Christoph von Tomme. Koichi is a principal consultant, and he was a jury member at the DevPortal Awards 2023. Thank you for listening.
Hey.
Hello.
You know the whole interface story, the interface portal, which is the idea that, like, in the first place, that you should have a developer portal that is about more than just APIs, but that you should also have your other interfaces there. I've been thinking about this one step further, as in interface portals as the place where you declare all your interfaces as an organization, where there is a switch from something for developers to something that helps people to understand how you function as an organization and how they can interact with you. I was talking about this idea with Swapna Sapar from PayPal. I don't know what came first, if I first talked about this, or he started talking about this graph they've just published with all their endpoints, basically. So they've created a single graph of everything PayPal. So you can, and the idea there is to make their interfaces discoverable for AI. I think he said that, and I was like, oh my God, this is like, this thing that I've been talking about and thinking about. It's the switch from, this is just something for developers to, okay, now this is the way that you tell the world how it can interact with you. And you could even imagine, like, one step further or a couple of steps further, that this could become a regulatory, basically something that the government says every organization needs to have. You provide a service, you have to have a cancellation and like a cancellation interface. And we don't care how it works, but you can't make people pay for it. You can't make people wait on the phone. You can't make people pay in time or in money. This is how you're supposed to do it. You could have a support interface for different products or a general one where there are certain requirements about how fast you have to get to a human if you're in a dead end, where all of this would enable radical automation of a lot of our interactions, so that this trying to find out how you do things with a company kind of disappears, and where we can focus more on qualitative interactions, and where also AI can start playing a really interesting role. We were talking about something like an interface manifest file, kind of like robot.txt, where you have this file that sits on your domain where you say, these are my interfaces. And that might be something that's generated by a developer portal. But the core idea is, rather than just saying, well, if you're a developer, go look for APIs, you say, here's all the ways you can interact with us. That's the idea.
Now, I think that was one of the big struggles in trying to tie revenue to technical interfaces, right? There's not a very obvious connection there. And unless you're doing just, you know, very straightforward transaction-based, you know, you pay 5 cents per call or something, which I think people are starting to realize is a fairly small number of the interfaces out there. Yes. You know, you get value out of doing more difficult things around data analysis, or, you know, just more complexity to build your app. And the reason I bring up the revenue part is you're always trying to get your APIs out there so people use them, right? And so it's not just about, like you're saying, not just about the API. It's how does this interface give me value in solving the challenges I'm looking to solve? And that doesn't have to be with some Python code necessarily. The answer could end up being a completely different interface, but if you only exposing it in that one way, then the chances of somebody discover it are pretty low. Part of the challenge is developers think developer.company.com should be for developers, right? They want to elevate the technical persona to the number one citizen for that website. And you know, in a lot of ways that makes sense. But then you start getting very narrow, technically focused things and start honing in on the minutiae of the technical accuracy of your products, when that may not matter if you never get to the audience you're looking for in the first place. So that balance is tricky. Yeah, getting first the developers that are bought in internally to kind of be okay with the idea that they're going to share this portal with non-developers, or at least developers that are not wearing that 100% technical hat and are just looking for problem-solving tools to add to their toolkit, or business people who, no engineer would ever want to call them technical at that level of business person. But if they can put an engineer onto a solution, at least you're selling the story to the right people. I think, you do a lot of disservice to your organization if you don't express all of that capability in the right way. And then it comes down to how do you do that? A standard around it would be interesting. You know, here are the database interfaces. Here are the REST interfaces. Here, you know, pick your standard Kafka, whatever, a kind of discoverability at the service level. But I don't know. I always felt like the human interface is the most effective right now.
So, but maybe you also want to declare your human interfaces. So maybe you have a range of here's our support, and it's purely human. It's a phone line. Here's our conversation bots. And like, and if you want to reach somebody after hours, maybe this can help you with some of the stuff. Here's our API, and you can do like a deep integration and do fancy stuff. Or you can have your LLM just query the API and just get you an answer. This range of what are the different ways that you can interact with us, and then also in what domains do we have a solution? And there might be certain domains where you have to have a solution because it's just unacceptable from a business perspective. And some of this might be about how you're going to be making money, but some of this might actually be just government saying, you know, in the near future, like what has happened to banking sector. You guys, you need to have an API for transactions. This year, you have to all have it. Large organizations are now also being forced to have APIs. So this is happening already today, but from a very different perspective, because they're starting from a very niche application rather than these really broad categories where I don't know if there is regulation that is forcing companies to have support, for example. I think you have to give warranty, but how do you fulfill that warranty? Is that defined? Like, what does that mean? What are the minimum requires, the SLAs that are obligatory by law? But you could imagine programmatically defining that and saying you have to have an endpoint, but it could be a human endpoint, just you have to have one.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. I wonder if that's spanning across industries would have to be like some governmental level. Like the CTO of the United States requires it to get incorporated or something. Or maybe it's tied to your .com registration.
Of course.
Some way, right?
Yeah. You just like now, if you are, I'm not sure if it's obligatory to have a website. I don't think it is obligatory. But when you do have a website in Belgium, you have to have your business details, like your registration number, your address, that has to be in your website. So there's already certain things that are required legally to have on your web presence. So then you could go a couple of steps further and see how this evolves and how it facilitates business. Because then I think this is probably one of the most groundbreaking transformations that I think LLMs will facilitate. Because to be able to do things with a personal AI agents, you need, so they could go and scan your websites to look for your interfaces. But why would we? And also, like, why are we making people scan our websites for interfaces? Like, why do they need to, like, try to understand our information architecture, like the bonkers way that we've come up for to name our products and how we do things? Why do we do this to people?
Yeah,
like, why
totally.
Don't we just, you know, we can totally make this more declarative. We can still have the human stuff. We can still have all the fancy, more fractal contents, but we could declare interfaces.
I don't know for how deep down the rabbit hole, but I would think companies like Salesforce or Oracle who deal in that kind of corporate reporting and CRM-ish information would be really eating this up. That kind of standardization of what it means to define your company and services digitally,
yeah.
Like Stripe, I would think, you know, because they help so much with that incorporation, creating APIs around building a business. It would be a natural fit to like extend what your e-commerce or, you know, all those things are doing. Yeah, that's interesting.
So, but the way that it fits, why I brought this up and starting this conversation, we just straight jumped in. The reason why I brought this up is because you are one of the examples of, or of the, you've worked in a team that has actually implemented an interface portal. And so I'm super excited to hear more about that. Like, how did it go? What were the obstacles? How do you sell it to management? What was the business driver for doing that? And how are the results? Like, and do you have any preliminary results of that? That I don't know if you can share it.
Yeah. But, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think it was a bit organic. I don't mm-hmm. know if it was like an epiphany or anything like that. Just trying to figure out how to communicate some of the more interesting things that sales engineers were doing with multiple APIs, right? That was one of the first challenges is, sure, we have APIs that do great things around data, but it's rare that a client's going to be satisfied with just that one thing. Their workflow is usually more complicated than that. So building up blueprints for that to show the art of the possible is the phrase they like to use was kind of the beginning of, well, this is not necessarily targeted to a developer, because if you just show them two different APIs and somebody said, hey, you need to incorporate this into your application, they could probably figure it out. But it's more to spark ideas of how they could replace some other APIs with a different set that gives them the capabilities in a different direction, and maybe even show them how to integrate into an application that we don't own, like you know, Microsoft or Salesforce or some of the other bigger players out there, and show that full stack through not just the services that you're selling. So that was kind of the genesis of it, how to relay that story and show that multiple challenges can be overcome, even if this API only does one thing. That doesn't mean, you know, we're trying to show the bigger picture, basically, put the whole thing together. And then since that started bringing in other technologies, then you start wondering how you could incorporate the UI components that are being shown in that recipe for how to build an end-to-end solution with multiple APIs and multiple other vendors. And it just kind of grew out of that need. So we realized, you know, you can't have a static documentation website, can't rely on just, say, you know, Swagger UI or some API renderer. You've got to be able to build a site that allows these kind of multiple stories to be told all around the, you know, what the technology capabilities are and the business value that they add, if you're coming at it from that perspective. And in the end, yes, you can always drill down to the specifics of that API. So we're not, you know, leaving a trail that they need to then follow again. But it was fairly organic. And I think, if to be honest, we went out and said, hey, we have this big plan to create an interface portal, that might have, you know, been a head scratcher. Whereas here, if you take it and say, we're going to take these interfaces and add them to this developer portal, they don't care that right now that all of those are just REST standard-based APIs. They care that, oh, my client can come and see all the capabilities we have as a company and pick and choose and realize just because they're looking at the REST page doesn't mean we don't have something. That full inventory was the primary goal. So I think that's where the non-API stuff really starts to creep in is, right now you've got a workflow that shows you can click through from an API call and then your data ends up in your Outlook calendar, right? That's not even our product. So that requires something much more than, just even a demo documentation. It's like a, that interface. I don't know.
Interface. Right? Yes. Yeah. The road for you was, it's almost like a capabilities or of another fancy word, affordances of your interfaces, of your APIs. So, and did you then structure it according to the affordances? Like, you know, you want to do X, or this is a job to be done, and here's like different ways to do it. That's how we structured it?
Yeah, then it kind of ended up being structured more based on what the internal teams were producing content-wise.
But that's an anti-pattern, right?
Yes, totally. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not ideal, but it was where, at least I think the one thing I'll say for it is that's where the client interfaces were. So when you're talking about salespeople talking with clients and realizing, oh, they actually want to buy those widgets that we don't currently sell, let's put that on there, right?
Yeah.
Or sales engineers talking across multiple products, they literally can't send them to one page because there's four product pages across, you know, static data, file delivery, database interface, you know, REST API, and UI widgets in a library. So you can't, we're just in the beginning of pulling all of that together and you know, doing it without confusing people even further.
and did people understand this?
I would say results mixed. Yeah. I think they get, because within those, there's use cases that work and don't work, but you have to try out some. You know, the ones that did resonate, you know, were probably the more popular. But yeah, then you end up with a bunch of use cases people don't look at, for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So and it's really like more like worked examples. Like, this is how you put all these pieces together to do a certain job.
Yeah, and to get to the same endpoint using services that company provides, rather than you know, a lot of times the low hanging fruit is automation and copying pasting content from one app to another app, right? Because you should definitely use an API for, and have those two apps integrated directly. Some pretty standard stuff, you know.
But then the categorization was according to the product categories that you were selling, so that when people were looking for this product categories or a salesperson was recommending something, then you had them together.
That's where the motivation, yeah.
Do you think it's possible to use like a sort of a domain modeling exercise to structure your interfaces also on the outside?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that that would have been possible. Yeah, I guess in this case, it was a mix of how would we break down by domain in that case?
I have not done anything like this. I know I've listened to people talk about it. I guess the challenge lies in that any kind of interface surface is going to be fractal in nature, no matter what you do. That there's always going to be like, I forgot, like there's this other company that does it this little way. And it's like coming to a complete surface mapping is going to be hard. Is it a single visualization? Is there a single hierarchy that you can use? Or do you need like a more of a network kind of thing or like some faceted search where you can like drill down on different aspects and just use keywords to pull stuff out?
Yeah, I was trying to stay away from hierarchy in those situations because the information is not as categorized as you would think, right? On the surface, it seems like a UI component should be in a UI category, but you know, if it's 100% reliant on data from a certain API, then you can't really... If it's one thing is to show that data, then separating the UI from the data ends up being awkward.
Exactly.
And putting them together is also obviously anti-pattern for other reasons. I don't know. Maybe the decision is around always what you're trying to communicate, what the story is you're trying to get across. So, you know, try not to be too strict about how those things are separated, rather making sure people are getting the story without being confused, you know.
I think it's, or at least theoretically, because I don't run these workshops, the information architecture workshops, but at least theoretically, I can imagine that you want to map out the most common jobs to be done and basically focus on different personas and different user journeys that you want to enable. But then probably still in a multi-hierarchy model where you can, you know, more like a graph than purely a hierarchical structure.
Speak directly to that. One of the big revamping that had to be done was the pages were completely, what do you call that, fit into the breadcrumb hierarchy 100%. Yeah. So every page was a node of, you know, the directory above it. And once we start pulling out capabilities and surfacing them on, you know, a landing page, a solution page, but you still want that to go back to one source of truth, then you have to break it immediately, right? So that's why I talk about the inflexibility of hierarchy being, you know, a little problematic. Yes. And I wouldn't stick to it unless you really, really, really had to for some reason. So most of the time you end up breaking it for a decent reason.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was much more like you have a bunch of nodes that need to point to other nodes. And so, you know, that kind of network gets built out rather than a really hierarchical tree structure.
Yeah. Well, it's like hierarchy can help us to create a single shared model that explains our company or our capabilities. So maybe from that perspective, doing an inside out, like top hierarchy can make sense, because if it's anyway products, those same products that people are buying, then it can make sense. I guess it's like more when you're really externalizing your internal kitchen that has nothing to do with how people interact with you on the outside, that you're really in dangerous territory, just simply because somebody worked in another department, they have their own piece.
Totally.
Yeah, totally.
Like, I guess the way I like to break that down is, if it's Apple and everybody knows, you know, the difference between an iPhone and a laptop, then, you know, you can present your APIs in two totally different places and nobody's going to really get confused. Yeah. But, you know, when you're a data company and you have a research division and you have a capital markets division and, you know, everybody has kind of the same data, that gets confusing quickly.
Yeah. What do you see next, and what are you excited about in the API scene?
I think, you know, since we scheduled this, I was at the point where I didn't see ChatGPT really being the existential threat to developers that, you know, was kind of being publicized. But, you know, in the 2 months since then, I'm hearing a lot of things I need to make sure are actually happening. You know, a friend of mine is writing code. He says is 95%, 99% accurate. He's not an engineer by trade, but, you know, we all write code time to time, writing very useful applications. So the rate of progress is actually surprising me, because I thought we were still in a hype cycle on working code, right? You know, if you write buggy code, creating a bigger problem than you're being helpful. But I think then this interface portal rather than API portal is absolutely the future, right? Because you're gonna need to communicate to multiple technology capabilities, but provide the same service, right?
Yeah.
I don't think that exists today. So that's, you know, it'd be interesting who comes up with the winning interface, whether it is the best in the end or just the most popular, right? There are a lot of interesting questions coming up when it comes to that. I think the end goal is going to be providing the working code rather than, hey, here's an API that you need to go code to, which really changes everything.
Is it your model? Is it the interface owner's large language model is it really a smart idea to make them provide the codes? Because the burden of validation, I cannot see API owners doing validation on whatever their LLMs are generating. So I think that it's anyway the person who is doing the integration that needs to do the validation. I'm not sure, but isn't that like a dead end street? Because any small hallucination and somebody who's really not technical, you have a disaster on your hands. I wonder if it isn't more that we need to make interfaces discoverable so that people can go and find the right interface and then do their own magic on it in their own environment, that they know, like, okay, this code might contain GPL codes and maybe that's not okay from a license perspective, but I'm fine with that. Or actually that allows people to do their own homework and put their own constraints on the output that they're willing to put in production. I know that there's companies that are experimenting with just spitting out some code that does the trick, but there's quite a lot of testing that's like in the legal courts that still is underway right now.
Yeah. And for me, it is all about the testing. I can imagine an ecosystem where the quality of that code generator is based on the quality of the tests, and the telemetry of the system and the log output. So even if you don't know that API inside and out, as a, let's say you're only interfacing it through a ChatGPT model and not directly, you could still have confidence that the service is doing what you think it is, even if you're writing less lines of code. But that requires much more transparency than I think most APIs have today. Yeah, so there's definitely a lot of underlying stuff. I was just surprised by the rate of progress on and individual APIs, right? So, you know, I gave one to a startup to run a demo and, you know, say, hey, find out the stock price of IBM yesterday. Mm-hmm. And he built a brand new LLM based on one OAS spec and, you know, had a working demo in a few hours, right?
Wow.
Which, you know, if I had tried that project as the owner of the developer portal, I think, you know, we might have seen a decent POC in 6 months, right? Because we're, you know, we're thinking about it from fresh and trying to learn the ins and outs of LLMs at the same time. And so for a very small company to be able to provide that transparency without him knowing anything about our APIs at the time and write a working app to display stock prices, that's the promise, right? The developer doesn't necessarily need to know 80% of your API documentation to be useful. Mm-hmm. I think that's what we're talking about. The overall thing with interfaces is you need to become an expert on what that thing is before you can use it successfully. I think the answer is going to be no, sooner rather than later.
I think we need to delineate our name models. Because what is an interface for you? Maybe actually we should start there. What is an interface for you?
I see it mostly from the technical asset level. So, you know, some kind of database at the end or a UI component or API call, something like that. Generate a transaction, get a receipt of completion or something like that.
So for me, well, I think about it from fairly abstract. I'm always very abstract, but like as a set of constraints that are narrowing the information or that are constraining information so that it enables new use cases in another place. I wonder, can you see a human as an interface? I think probably human plus processes can be an interface for an organization. Because you are constraining the interactions to a single individual, possibly further constraining it with additional processes about how they are interacting, maybe tools that they're interacting through. And then you're not just bombarding every single individual in that organization or all their systems with whatever request that you're trying to do.
It almost sounds like a channel and a protocol.
I guess. I don't know. Does that make sense? Because I've thought a lot about this and I've tried to, like, this is how I think about this. A lot of way I think about it is based in biology, because I'm a bioengineer by education. So, the way that for a very long time now, whenever I was talking about interfaces, I'm thinking about like hormonal receptors on cell membranes that are, or ion channels in through cell membranes that are allowing certain very specific things to go through and other things to not go through, and that are then triggering certain reactions from internally and externally based on what is happening and what is being exposed or what is being internalized. And then the way cells work, basically, you have two layers, especially in animals and plant life. So in bacteria, it's less protected. But when you have a nucleus, you have another layer of that. Like you have another interface layer that is protecting a certain area from the rest of the cell. And then in the cell, all kinds of random stuff is happening. Or there's a crazy complex mixture of components that are interacting with each other. But then at the boundary, you're shielding all of that off and you're saying like, okay, this is a liver cell. It cleans up stuff and it gets rid of alcohol and cleans up fats and whatever. But it has this receptor and that receptor and that's that's how it functions and it's protected from the rest of so you basically have an area where it's like, well, this is connected to the concept of deliberate complexity. It's like you choose where you apply your complexity and where you actually exclude complexity so that you can get higher levels of organization happening and much more interesting symbiosis and so on. And I think a similar pattern is also what we're doing with software, where especially with APIs now, where we're saying, okay, we have our team or like the Bezos mandates, you know, every team needs to have APIs and that's the only way you're supposed to interact with each other. That is exactly that. So it's like the team becomes a cell. It has a defined surface through which it can communicate with the other cells. And then those communicate with the broader world and the ecosystems that they're creating. That's how I think about it in a very, very abstract way.
That's kind of the way I was picturing it. I think the biology example is probably better because you're, you know, that's interfaces and inputs and outputs, surface of the cell membrane is a good way to visualize it for sure. I was just thinking too, parallels how much everything humans do and can be described in nature. You know, even something as completely made up as the syntax of a coding language and writing code and the way it behaves and the error rates. And it's amazing how much all of that can mimic nature.
You start looking at DNA and it's the same thing. It's a programming language, very different language that does different things. But the one other thing, though, is that there's no clear boundaries. So, yes, there is a boundary, but even that boundary, water molecules are still going through. Depends a bit on what. But the context in which that system is operating still has an effect. It's somehow filtered out, but there is still an effect of... So you're focusing and you are amplifying certain contextual pieces of information, but that full context is still there and still doing its thing. And I think probably that's a similar what we're going to have with organizations and these socio-technical interfaces and boundaries, where the humans will still be embedded in their wider society. They will still be influenced by what's going on around them. But you can start like trying to create some sort of information boundary between different teams, and then there might be some. Hyperliminal connections between different parts, but for the most part, you get these somewhat shielded information contexts where different things are happening. And then the APIs are like the highways that are connecting these different systems. There's some slow leakage through the superliminal model. I also think about this from an organizational perspective. Like, what are the new ways of organizing that are enabled by these new technologies? Because in the past, hierarchical systems where you had like a boss telling you what you can do and so on was the way that you could organize a larger, or at least that we say that we can organize a large group. But now these new structures, they're enabling different ways of collaboration. And yeah, you know, and then also, what does that do for the economy? Because economically, this level of interaction and interdependence will also change things significantly, I think.
Yeah, it's funny, you end up on the thread of the internal, I guess, benefits that I was going to bring up as part of that challenge for creating interfaces. If you did do it internal first, you would need to create all of these basically contracts, right, between teams and, yes, you know, how they operate, what's their inputs and outputs, kind of the expected return between it. And that absolutely goes into how your organization is structured and, you know, where engineering fits in that when you're trying to write software at the end of the day. So, yeah, I think doing the exercise of exposing interfaces as your main goal, as your outcome, rather than APIs versus data files, mm-hmm, or whatever, would, I think, naturally lead to that internal discussion first. How are we even going to accomplish this and present ourselves to clients or the world in a way that makes a lot of sense when internally you know that there's legal over there and there's support over there. Everybody's got their own metrics and what they consider success. But if you don't define them internally to that level, then how can you ensure that outcome every time? I mean, obviously, you can't. But we do go around thinking that we do with layers of management instead.
It gets worse because when you start creating these boundaries, when these boundaries are too hard, then you get local sub-optimization. Because now there's a team that has their own purpose that's completely devoid of the overarching purpose that's like driving you off the cliff.
Yeah, and it's difficult to get them to change just a little bit. They become very good at just, you know, doing that one exact thing. And then even a 5% change becomes 10x the cost of what you thought it would. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I don't know if you've come across some companies trying out a pod model. I think it's a step in the right direction when it comes to Agile. I think a lot of companies have missed the point completely of Agile and really need to rethink how they are operating. Yeah. The pod thing sounds interesting. I think you're still going to struggle with, organizational issues. For me, it's a more natural way of working. You have formal lines of communication when, all right, this is going to be a problem on this service, then, you know, that's your guy in operations and that's your guy in support. You know, you kind of need that established to really accomplish stuff.
So where I struggle with all of this is that it makes interactions more transactional. I did a training course on 3M. It's similar to cell philosophy, which was something from a Dutch company, where basically when somebody has an idea, they can like propose it, and then they make a sort of contract with the rest of the organization. This is what we need to be able to achieve this. This is what we're going to put in. This is what you're going to put in. This is what the other is going to put in. And when we achieve this, we're going to split the revenues this way. Sounds super fascinating, super interesting. But when I started thinking about how to implement this in our organization, the first thing I started thinking is like, so what about, just like with care work, what about all the invisible work that people are doing to make things work? If that is not on those sheets, then what's going to happen with that? And what does that mean for the company culture? And so it's that, it's like with humans, like we're driving all our interactions into the transactional realm where everything becomes a money purchase. Where more and more we're isolated as individuals or as families, like as the nuclear family unit is becoming more and more isolated. And it gives us a lot more power. There's a lot of good things that come with it. But at the same time, we're also losing a lot of that social cohesion that makes it worth to be a human. At the same time, this interface or this drive towards boundaries and interfaces everywhere and the transactionalization of society, I'm not sure if that is necessarily what we want.
I totally agree. And maybe, I feel like when I speak about it, that level of efficiency does sound totally transactional. Yeah, I have to find a better way to express it because it is what you're saying, the idea that there's a relationship established. And yes, there is the protocol and the transaction is there. Yeah. But then that allows for, once you have the transaction down, it's almost effortless, right? Mm-hmm. So as long as you build that, then, you know, you still need the relationship and the ownership part of we're all in this together for anything to work. Yeah, I didn't mean to reduce it to just the transaction. But yeah, I'll keep that in mind because I feel like every time I bring that up, people, now I'm starting to realize I make it sound more transactional than I mean.
And that is the part that is the most visible. And it's the transaction that becomes visible. And it's not the relationship kind of disappears in the background. It's like with all the big, like the sharing platforms, like the Airbnbs and stuff. I used to be a huge Airbnb fan. I still use Airbnb. But like I was in London a couple of weeks ago and my host, they were using this service for keys. And okay, so normally you get like a lockbox where you get a code and then you have to like get your key and then you can get into the house. And that's not very safe. So I get that. So they've apparently in London, there's now this service where the day and night shop has like a key and an app where you go and say, hey, I'm this person, like I need my key. And then you get your key. But what this enabled was that the interaction with the host was reduced to the bare minimum. So I met the host, who's a nice guy, but I was used to just having a little chat and just, you know, getting a feel for how is life here. And very shortly in that conversation, it was like, okay, yeah, so I'm back to my work now, or something like that, which is totally understandable. But basically, that interaction where there was a whole lot of friction of getting your key and getting into the house and being shown around what is where and how are we doing things here, all of that got automated. And now this thing that used to be an opportunity for human contact had become a complete transaction. And so now I'm thinking, like, you know, maybe I better start doing hotels again, because maybe I'm actually going to get a better service, because that human part is gone anyway. And that was an interesting experience. So I wonder if this is something similar that we're doing to society. How can we do deliberate complexity where we spend the complexity where it matters for humans, and where we, you know, reduce the complexity where it is just frustration? How do we make sure that it's like that we're going to do it instead of the other way around?
Yeah, exactly. Like, everybody assumes people want the lowest friction interaction possible, but maybe not. You know, maybe the value is in the higher touch, right?
This is also something we've seen in developer experience, is that, so I for a lot, very long time, I've been talking about developer experience as the inverse of friction, which makes it easy because you can just go look for friction. But then I started realizing that when you are trying to monetize an API, or when you're trying to do value-based selling, for example, you're trying to figure out, you know, what are they making, or how much money are they making using the API and all the work that I've put in, and like, can I get some piece of the pie? Then you can consciously start. Typically, what happens is that people reintroduce friction, but it's friction that is performing work. So there are constraints that are creating friction. But those constraints are actually helping you to get value back out of the system. Right. Alicia Guerrero, she's a super smart person, a philosopher who's now running a biotech business. And she wrote this book, Dynamics in Action. This was her first big work that is talking about this concept. And now she wrote a new one, which is Context Changes Everything. And she talks about enabling, the difference between enabling and governing constraints. And I hope I do justice to her work. It's pretty complex. it's super interesting. It's like it changes how you look at the world. But there's enabling constraints are between two layers where both layers are still interacting. And I think they're not set in stone. So like the other type is governing constraint. And it's like it's a constraint that you can't really change anymore. And it's just you have to take it the way that it is. And I think that when you use power over to force a certain constraint into a system and you create all of this artificial friction, then, yeah, you lose, like you no longer have that interaction, that dynamic back and forwards between the two layers that is optimizing it to make it something that enables something, and it's rather just, you know, reducing it. Had you heard of some of this, like enabling and governing constraints?
A little bit. No, I think it's definitely interesting. How do you get the quality without being too dictatorial? Kind of, yeah. The challenge. And it's fascinating. And one of the best examples I think in my career has been arguing, you know, going, trying to set a governance standard, rolling it out, communicating to all the teams, and just having the most esoteric, in my mind, useless conversations, because, you know, you're talking about, hey, why is this in the standard? Okay, but are you ever going to use that feature? So I understand why you care from like a, you know, your professional level, but why are we continuing to bring up this point when you know, the chances anybody hit this part of the spec, like 1%, right?
Yeah.
In the whole history of this existence in this API. Let's focus on the big rocks and move forward. Then, as we roll the tool out as a linting tool, we just enforce all of the rules that we were debating about for months. And day one, same exact engineer is like, oh, it didn't pass this test. And then I changed the spec. And like, no more arguing about the details of what the rules are. The tool is failing his spec on the rules that he was fighting for. And he still just, once the tool does it, he's just following the tool. You know, and all the debate disappeared. Yeah, sometimes there is just that mechanism of, no, you can't do that anymore. And let's move on with our lives rather than trying to decide whether we should or not. And then, you know, endlessly debating about it, right?
But you could, well, you could wonder, why did he argue with you? Was it because he really wanted that thing? Or was it the interaction with you that he was seeking? Was it the fact that he was standing up against power? Or, and like, and once it's a machine, it's just a machine that's failing. It's a test that I'm failing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. It was definitely a bit of that. It was a bit of, to be honest, inexperience. You know, I've found more and more in my career people who have experience with APIs in the first 5, maybe even 10 years of their career, depending on their career paths, usually think, you know, everything is religion. This is the one way, you know. This is the way you do APIs, and this is amazing. And that, yeah, because that fits the use cases and your organization and, you know, your engineering capabilities, what you are trying to interface with. All of those fit for those answers for that time. But if you go and try and redo that at a completely different company with a different data set or whatever, it's probably not going to work. So, you know, you have to realize that there isn't any one way ever. You really need that context, you know, as the title of the book indicates, or else you're just doing stuff to do stuff, you know, you're, and to argue in a theoretical framework, that is the part of the governance that you have to get over.
Well, fascinating world. With what we lose, we also gain. It's almost kind of like rediscovering what it is to be human by going through this hyper-machine flow and like and realizing what are the important bits that we didn't even realize that were important.
Yeah, totally. I think that was where I was going with my thoughts around the proprietary versus standards for APIs. I think there's always a perception that open is better for whatever reason, and companies that do proprietary APIs are evil or just trying to hide something. And, you know, being now on both sides and more involved in a program that rigorously sticks to standards, I realize there's a lot of unnecessary stuff there too. You know, it's not all positive just because there is a standard.
For what it's worth, right? Because I'm not a prophet nor a technology visionary. But another prediction that I've been making based on worldly mapping is that and worldly mapping is this tool where you can like kind of predict how technology will evolve based on moving from initial kind of custom made to products to utilities. And there's like an initial inception before all of that. So I think right now APIs are in the product phase, which means that different companies are still creating their own kind of API context in which they're operating. But I think that I start already seeing at the horizon some industries where APIs are now getting into the utility phase, where there's a standard across the industry that everybody's implementing. And like there are problems with that also. But it means that not every company has to reinvent their own API design. And then the utility of or the usefulness of that API design becomes even more valuable because now you have an API that is not only facilitating automated interactions with someone who's integrated with them, but that facilitates interactions with everybody else that has applied that standard either on the receiving or on the producing end. So I think as APIs mature, more and more will become utility APIs. It sounds like you're in maybe in one of those projects.
I feel like the standards have allowed the companies to embrace APIs for sure. And now they're starting to figure out not everything should be an API, basically. Mm-hmm. Right. Not everything that you're gonna expose to clients necessarily needs to be an API. There's the gold rush of exposing it all because they hear a story about some API making Google Maps, you know, $1 billion or something, which is probably just marketing. And still missing the point of what outcome does your client expect when they go to use that product? And if they don't have any expectation, then you probably don't need an API for that thing. When you say it's the product phase for APIs, it's kind of like that explosion of everything is a product, get it all out there. And then in the future, companies can feel more secure that they don't have to do everything via an API.
I think right now, APIs are differentiators. If you have, as an organization, you have a really good set of APIs and a really great developer portal, then that helps you to differentiate against your competitors. I think in the future, they're going to become more and more table stakes and also more and more standardized so that certain common functions like bank transactions, what already happens in Europe with PSD2, or maybe insurance taking or support requests, or cancellations of services. Maybe all of these become standard APIs for inside of a given industry or across the economy. Like what happened with PSD2, like the forcing all the banks to have open APIs for transactions enabled a whole new generation of financial services companies that were building stuff on top of those banks across the whole market. And similarly, I think standardization of API design will result in some of this stuff and might even be regulatory obligatory. I feel I took you on like a wild trip.
Yeah, that's fun. Yeah.
All my favorite topics. So thank you very much for...
thank you. This has been a total pleasure.
That's it for this episode. This episode of the Resilience Podcast was brought to you by Pronovix. You can learn more about our company at pronovix.com. And thank you for listening. And until next week.